Thank you all for coming today. I'd like to welcome you to the first meeting of the Gonzaga Socratic Club for spring 2009. Our topic today is Can I Know It Is God Speaking to Me? Teresa Avila's Contribution to Discernment of Spirits. We do have a program change today, which I'll tell you a little bit more about in a few moments. Father Tim Clancy was going to be our respondent today, but due to the death of his father, he's away for the funeral. So if you would keep Father Tim in your prayers, that would be appreciated. The Gonzaga Socratic Club seeks to promote open philosophical discussion into the Christian worldview. In the spirit of Socrates, our aim is to, quote, follow the argument wherever it leads, as Socrates said, concerning the truth of Christian doctrine and practice. We take our inspiration from the famous Oxford Socratic Club, which was founded at Oxford University in 1941 and presided over by the famous Christian apologist C.S. Lewis from its founding until his move to Cambridge in 1954. Our topic today, as I said, is Can I Know It Is God Speaking to Me? Teresa of Avila's Contribution to Discernment of Spirits. The earliest philosophers of ancient Greek sought to ask what principles govern all of perceivable reality. Reflections on this matter soon turned to the question of ultimate reality. Is there some source for all things beyond our perception, perhaps even beyond our understanding? The earliest and most influential thinker who asked this question was the philosopher Parmenides, who discussed the question of being in a mystical poem in which a goddess conveys him to an interview in which he starts spouting syllogisms. This idea is echoed, and the theme is picked up in Plato's Republic when the character Socrates describes that paragon of ultimate reality, the principle of the good, and he says of it, the good is beyond being, surpassing it in wealth and power. And we find the theme from Parmenides to Plato taken up then by the Neoplatonists, those rational mysticists, who try to articulate the nature of the one, which is ineffable, but is the source of all things. Now, this train of thought is important because it provides the framework for early Christian thinking, particularly through such figures as St. Augustine. But it poses a problem for Christianity, and really a broader philosophical problem, which is the one that we want to address today. On the one hand, God is beyond human understanding. As the prophet Isaiah reminds us, speaking for God, my thoughts are not your thoughts. My ways are not your ways. But on the other hand, God reveals himself to us and wants us to know him and his purposes for us. So we have a question. To what extent is God knowable? To what extent can we understand what God reveals to us about himself and his will for us? That's the topic we want to address today. Our speaker, Dan Bradley, is a former Gonzaga student in philosophy who graduated from Gonzaga in 1999 and went on to the National University of Ireland at Galway. He's just completed a dissertation titled The Ambiguity of Desire, Truth and Illusion in the Discernment of the Divine. Now that sounds rather confusing perhaps, but it's all about what we're talking about today. How can we know God, or can we know God? And in particular, how can we discern when purported communications from the divine are not communications from God? He has a particular interest in contemporary continental philosophy, and he has tried to bring the famous spiritual guide and teacher, St. Teresa of Avila, into communication, into dialogue with the contemporary continental tradition. So with no further ado, let's hear from our speaker, Dan Bradley. Thank him for speaking to us today.
Thank you. First of all, I'm very grateful for the existence of the Socratic Club, so thank you for keeping this going. My journey in philosophy has always been motivated by trying to think through the relation between our thinking and between God. My journey wasn't motivated so much merely by thinking through logical puzzles, but by thinking this question, can we know ultimate reality? And ultimately, can we know God? And I'm very grateful for the opportunity to present some ideas to you all this afternoon. I'm still very inexperienced in philosophy and searching for truth. I've only been studying for 12 years, right? And I like the Europeans, in contemporary philosophy they say, unless you've been studying Husserl for 10 years, you shouldn't be publishing or you still need to be working. So I've got a lot of work to do. In the Discourse on Method, Descartes writes, "It has rarely happened that an objection has been raised, which I had not already wholly foreseen, except when it was quite wide of the mark. Thus I have almost never encountered a critic of my views who did not seem to be either less rigorous or less impartial than myself." Well, in the spirit of inquiry today, I look for critics more rigorous than myself and closer to the mark. So what I'd like to do is, rather than present a position that I want to defend, first of all state a problem, and then sketch out one possible solution. But mostly I'd like to open up a discussion that we can work through. And this discussion, what I want us to think today, is the tension between the two quotes we have here. I don't have much technological wizardry for you today, but this is all, and this, I think, will guide our investigation. On the one hand, Teresa of Avila, who I take a lot of my inspiration from, she was a Spanish mystic and nun in the 1500s, and she started the Discalced Carmelites, if you know a bit of the history of this order. Anyway, she tells us, she says, "It's a glorious bewilderment, a heavenly madness, in which true wisdom is acquired, as the soul a fulfillment most full of delight." So our contact with God is beyond the full understanding of our mind. This is beyond what we can clearly and distinctly understand with the categories of our intellect. And yet she also tells us, on the other hand, if the soul wonders if the whole thing was an imagination, if it has been asleep, if the fable was a gift of God, or if the devil was transfigured into an angel of light. It retains a thousand suspicions, and it is well that it should, for as I said, we can sometimes be deceived in this, even by our own nature. So what I understand and what I want us to try and think through is this tension. On the one hand, God must transcend what we can understand with our thinking. And yet, on the other hand, we must judge that which comes to us, right, if we are not to remain mired in illusion and in superstition. That's the tension that I want to think through. And the basic thrust of my investigation, it will be the claim that contemporary continental philosophy, which is philosophy that was inspired by the French and German writers of the 20th century, themselves following in the footsteps of Edmund Husserl, and before him Kierkegaard, Nietzsche, and Kant, that this continental tradition has much to say to us who are interested in using the tools of philosophy to help us better to know and to follow, to love and to worship the God who ceaselessly calls us. Particularly for those of us who want to listen to both the Greek philosophical and the Abrahamic religious traditions. Now, in particular, within this strand of continental philosophy, I think that the tradition or sub-tradition inspired by Emmanuel Levinas, consisting primarily of Jacques Derrida, Jean-Luc Marion, John Caputo, and Merrill Westphal, this group that I will call late post-Kantian phenomenology, or phenomenology of alterity. Now, this is a lot of names, but we can perhaps, at least Derrida has probably come up on the radar for some of you. And we can talk about each one of these if you have particular interests afterward in our discussion. But the idea is that these phenomenologists of alterity, this tradition, warns us with a powerful and continually renewed voice to turn away from our intellectual idols and to be open to the coming of a God that far surpasses the limits of anything that we can grasp or anything that we can conceive. These writers remind us again and again that our concepts cannot contain God, and that when we take our concepts to be the real living God, then we are committing the idolatry. For what we are doing is we are worshiping human-made artifacts, For ideas can be idols just as much as calves made of gold. Nonetheless, as valuable as this reminder remains, and always will be, the work of these philosophers must be supplemented, I think. For because they give us no way to think the presence of God, they ultimately leave us unable to judge between the coming of the divine, the vagaries of my imagination, and the dark forces that would destroy us. However, I think this tradition, this phenomenology of alterity, late post-Kantian phenomenology, can be supplemented using the works of Teresa of Avila. For Teresa is very sympathetic to the kinds of worries that these thinkers have about our intellectual idolatry, about worshipping our own concepts. And yet she's able to give us a way of judging what appears to us. Thus she is able to help us avoid both the idolatry of a philosophy that forces God to serve its ends, the ends of philosophy, in gaining mastery over the world, and a philosophy, on the other hand, that is so preoccupied with iconoclasm and rooting out the constituting influences of the self in our experience that it fails to be able to judge what comes to us. So to help articulate this problem, I want to start by turning to Plato's dialogue, the Euthyphro. In this dialogue, I'm sure many of you will remember that Socrates meets Euthyphro on the steps of the courthouse. Socrates is there, he's about to be tried for his life, for impiety and corrupting the youth. Well, Euthyphro is at court to set up a date to try his father. One of Euthyphro's servants, in a drunken rage, had killed another servant, and Euthyphro's father bound this servant and threw him in a ditch, and while they were waiting for the authorities, the servant had died. So now Euthyphro is at court to set up a trial to prosecute his father. And perhaps this would have sounded even stranger, prosecuting your father, to the Greeks than it would to us today. And so Euthyphro defends his actions by saying, piety demands that we prosecute whoever is guilty of injustice, whether they be my father or not. So then Socrates, using his famous or perhaps infamous irony, says, well, if you're doing something like this, teach me about piety, because you surely must know. Right? If you're going to do something like this, you surely must know what piety is. So you can help me, you can teach me, you can tell me what piety is. So we engage in a typical Socratic dialogue along the lines of what is. You know, in the Republic we say, what is justice? Here we're trying to determine what is piety. And of course, as we often see in the Socratic dialogues, the interlocutor, this time is Euthyphro, tries to give examples. He says, piety is doing this or doing that. And Socrates tells him, I don't want examples. What we need to do is find a definition that gets to the essence of what we're looking for. That way, when we come across an example, something in our world, we will know whether this is an example of what we're looking for or not. So, Euthyphro tries, and eventually he comes to this idea that what piety must be is what all of the gods love. Well, as Socrates points out, there's a problem with this. We're left with what has come to be known as Euthyphro's dilemma. Either what is good because it's loved by the gods, or the gods love what they do love because it's good. You can see the problem, right? If what is good because God says it is, then how are we to say that God is good? Next week, or 30 seconds from now, God could say that eating babies is good. And it would be, of course, if we take this horn of this dilemma. If what is good is whatever God says it is, then we would be in this kind of position. So is what is pious or good merely good because the gods happen to say it's good right now, for no other reason than because it matches their capricious will? Well, no. So if we take the first horn of this dilemma, then we are left with a God that's not good. If, however, we say that God loves what is good because it's good, then we have a good God, but not one that's all-powerful. For God has to look to some external standard to conform, base his judgments. There must be a higher level of reality than God. God's looking to a standard that determines his actions, then, which, of course, then he wouldn't be God. So certain shallow thinkers like Bertrand Russell Bertrand Russell says this disproves the existence of God. Euthyphro's dilemma means the God of the book cannot exist. Well, of course, we can easily say that this is a false dilemma. We don't have to choose one of these choices. It's certainly very rational to say that there is a standard of goodness and justice that's not based on the bare will and raw power of God. But it's not an external standard either, for this goodness is rooted in the nature of God. So in that sense, the will of God isn't arbitrary or capricious, but neither is it external to his nature. So this dismisses adolescent atheists, right? But it leaves us with an epistemological human problem. How do we know what is pious? Rather than how we think what is pious. For if we say that we know it is good because it came from God, then we lose the power of judgment and we must accept whatever comes to us in the name of God. But if, on the other hand, we say that we know it's God because it conforms to a standard that we can understand, then we are forcing the divine into our categories of rationality, and thus committing the idolatry of worshipping our own thinking. So the dilemma is rephrased. If we look at it as an epistemological problem about what we can know, we might say, is our understanding of what is good derived from what God says? Or is our understanding of God derived from what our thinking says? Right? So we have this kind of problem. How are we to know what appears as God? Interestingly, if we look to the stories about Abraham, we seem to be pointed in both directions. When Abraham first learned of God's intention to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, he challenges God, gently and humbly, but he challenges God. Abraham says to God, "Far be it from me to do such a thing, to slay the righteous with the wicked, so that the righteous and the wicked are treated alike. Far be it from me. Shall not the judge of all the earth deal justly?" And the Lord said, "If I find at Sodom 50 righteous in the city, I will spare the whole place for their sake." He changes his mind, or changes what he says he's going to do. Then Abraham says, "Okay, look, I know I was pushing my luck. I'm really sorry. I who am but dust and ashes, I'm sorry for..." What if you find 40? What if you find 40 righteous men? God says, "Okay, all right. For the sake of the 40, I will spare the city." We can just imagine Abraham. "Okay, I know I'm really pushing my luck here. Right? What if I find 30? God says, "Okay." And we keep going like this, lower and lower. Abraham pushing God. So it seems to be that in this story, Abraham is saying, this could not be God's action. Anything that would destroy the whole city, the just and the unjust alike, is not God. Right? Because this doesn't conform to what's right. So it couldn't be God. This couldn't be what you will do. Then, of course, we get the famous story of Isaac and Abraham, in which we get the opposite end of this dilemma, of our problem. And it seems to be that Abraham consents to what appears to be a monstrous act to kill his own son, right? Merely because the command of God must exceed all human understanding. Then when we get to the New Testament seems to deepen the challenge, besides the story of Isaac, to any attempt to understand God according to our ways of making sense of things. Right? You can take any of the parables if you want. We get the workmen who start at the six in the morning, the ones who start at noon, and the ones who start at 5, and the ones who start at 6, and at the end they all get the same wages, right? Jesus tells us over and over in the parables, God's ways are not your ways. Your logic cannot contain God's logic. Your ways of understanding will never contain God. Finally, the crucifixion defies our understanding completely. And because of this scandal of the cross, Paul tells us, if anyone supposes that he knows anything, he is not yet known as he ought to know. But if anyone loves God, he is known by him. So the critique coming from the phenomenological writers of the 20th century tells us as, that as a people who would listen to both the Abrahamic tradition and of the philosophical tradition, we have failed. For we have been roped into taking the second horn of Euthyphro's dilemma, the philosophical horn, the one that Socrates takes. They warn us that we have agreed to allow God into our thinking only where he fits into the categories established by our reason, in its attempt to understand and to master, to gain control of the world. We see roots of this movement starting with Kant and Kierkegaard, but beginning with Immanuel Levinas, we have a unified and coherent movement that is motivated by the desire to be open to that which comes to us from beyond our ideas, from beyond what we can control, manipulate, and constitute with our ego. Phenomenology is constantly aware of the break between the way that something presents itself to us, the givenness of the aspects we perceive, and what we perceive the thing as, or intentionality. For example, I forgot my cube, right? But if I had a cube, phenomenologists always use the example of a cube. But if we think about a cube, what do you see? You see three sides. Right? So the cube presents itself as an aspect of three sides that you can observe, and yet that's its givenness, we say in technical terms in phenomenology, and yet we understand it as a cube. So we have to think through, as phenomenologists, this relation between the way a thing presents itself and what we understand it as, givenness and intentionality. For a phenomenologist, it is here within the break between intentionality and givenness that the possibility for contact with a true transcendence occurs. So we can understand the work of Levinas himself, Derrida, Jean-Luc Marion, John Caputo, and others, as working out different ways for thinking this break. I know I'm not going to talk too much more about phenomenology. If that comes up in the discussion, we can talk about it. Right? But the important thing to see here is that all of these phenomenologists are motivated by the same passionate desire to be open to a true alterity that lies beyond the confines of the categories of my own understanding. This is the drive. This is the passionate yearning that motivates them. For Levinas, the ethical relationship is marked by desire for the other as other, which frees the encounter from being eternally dragged back within the sphere of determination based on my own being. In Totality and Infinity, this is Levinas' famous work. If you're interested in this, it's an unbelievable work. Levinas claims that this rupture into my sphere of subjectivity reveals, quote, the other for whom I can no longer be the measure, and who precisely in his uniqueness is refractory to every measure. Again, he tells us that the encounter with the other is the incomprehensible transfiguration of an order in which every signified meaning goes back to the appearing of the world, that is, to the identification of the same, that is, to being. A new rationality, or perhaps we should say the most ancient one, prior to what coincides with the possibility of the world, and consequently does not lead back to ontology. Finally, Levinas is explicit that this desire for alterity must lie at the heart of philosophy. Metaphysics, he tells us, is the movement from a world that is familiar to us, chez soi, right, toward an outside of oneself, hors de soi. He tells us the term of this movement, the elsewhere of the other, is called other in an eminent sense. No journey, no change of climate or of scenery could satisfy the desire bent toward it. The other metaphysically desired is not other, like the bread I eat, the land in which I dwell, the landscape I contemplate, like sometimes myself for myself, this I, that other. I can feed on these realities and to a very great extent satisfy myself as though I had simply been lacking them. Their alterity is thereby reabsorbed into my own identity as a thinker or a possessor. The metaphysical desire tends towards something else entirely, towards the absolutely other. That's what he tells us in Totality and Infinity. And I could produce an endless string of these kind of quotations along these lines from this tradition. But let's look at just one more from Derrida. Derrida tells us, isn't it proper to desire to carry with it its own proper suspension, the death or the phantom of desire? To go toward the absolute other, Isn't that the extreme tension of a desire that tries to renounce its own proper momentum, its own movement of appropriation? And I think they're right about this, about desire. The nature of desire is to transcend the boundaries of my own being in an opening toward the other, toward the beloved. Right? When we love, we want to touch the beloved and be touched by them. We want to be in contact with something outside of ourselves. We're called by something that we do not create. And this, I don't think this is some kind of idiosyncratic understanding of desire. For example, just to pick at random, we see that in the Divine Names, Pseudo Dionysius, he tells us, the divine Eros is ecstatic. It does not permit lovers to be among themselves, but bids them to be among their lovers. So love, which is a gift of God, this Eros, is a movement beyond ourselves. It constantly forces us to transcend the limits of our own being. Again, we see from the Summa Theologica, Aquinas claims that the cognitive power follows the mode of the knower and is known in the knower. The appetitive power moves towards things in respect of their condition. So this is what it is. It's desire that draws us towards the thing as it is, rather than as we know it according to our own categories. So, this protest that I'm bringing to our attention from the tradition of the phenomenology of alterity, if this protest against the philosophical temptation to reduce all experience to the immanence of our understanding is not new, it's one that's largely been forgotten since Aquinas. So the tradition of the phenomenology of alterity has been a wonderful addition to contemporary intellectual thought. I think it's reminding us of something very important. It reminds us of the constant temptation to let our thinking about God harden into intellectual idols that then insulate us from the very God we set out to know. The way in which our thinking we build up is a kind of cocoon that prevents our world being penetrated by God. Nonetheless, despite the great resources offered by this tradition, it does not offer us a satisfactory model for thinking our relation to God. If we must always be conscious not to force God within the limits of our concepts, still we must be able to judge that which comes to us. As Teresa tells us, after a vision or a visitation from God, the soul wonders if the whole thing was imagination, if it's been asleep, if the favor was a gift of God, or if the devil was transfigured into an angel of light. We can be tricked, so we must judge. We must be able to tell the difference between God or imagination and a darkness that would turn us away from God. And the tradition of the phenomenology of alterity is unable to perform this discernment, I think. Levinas, Derrida, Marion, they all make alterity itself the criterion of discernment that underlies our process of evaluation. For these thinkers, we ought to value an encounter precisely to the degree that it escapes our understanding, as alterity. So it's alterity itself that becomes the value. Again, we could look to numerous passages to see this, but we don't have a whole lot of time, so perhaps we can come back to this in our discussion. But for now, let's just look to Derrida's book, Donner la Mort, or The Gift of Death, where he's reflecting on the problem of responsibility with this famous battle cry, tout autre et tout autre, which we can't really translate. He's making a kind of play here. Every other is every other. Every bit of otherness is completely other. This is what he tells us. Everything points to the fact that I am unable to be responsible at the same time before the other and before others, before the others of the others. If God is completely other, here we go, right? If God is completely other, the figure or name of the holy other, then everyone is every bit other. Tout autre et tout autre. It implies that God, as holy other, is to be found everywhere there is something other. Everywhere there is to be found something of the holy other. And since each of us, everyone else, each other, is infinitely other in its absolute singularity, inaccessible, solitary, transcendent, non-manifest, ordinarily non-present to my ego, then what can be said about Abraham's relation to God can be said about my relation without relation to every other. To every other one, every bit other. Tout autre comme tout autre. In particular, my relation to my neighbor or my loved ones, who are as inaccessible to me, as secret and transcendent as Yahweh. Now, this is convoluted language. You tend to be somewhat pedantic in contemporary philosophy. What he's saying is, every experience of otherness is equally other, right? And that's the criteria on which we're going to judge our encounters. To the degree that it's a radical alterity, that is something that I can't confine or contain within my thinking. And for Derrida, and this is true of the tradition, we're unable to judge between one alterity and the next, between this other and the others. But if we take the problem of evil seriously, then we know that there are others that must be rejected. So even if we rightfully acknowledge our inability to bring these others under the spotlight of our conceptual understanding, we must still somehow judge them. We still must somehow judge our experience. This means that the impossible and radical undecidability, these are things you'll have heard from Derrida, right? Must not have the final word in one's life. For it's only when we are unable to decide that the darkness becomes a source of terror. As the Book of Wisdom tells us, the more one's expectation is of itself uncertain, the more one makes of not knowing the cause that brings on torment. It's repeated several times in the Book of Wisdom that the darkness itself is powerless. The night that blocks out sight and denies the ability to know. It's not the night that itself is problematic. It's only after the soul is stricken by its own weakness and its inability to judge that it's bound in the unbarred prison of terror. For in the soul's rejection of the dark and the fear of the loss of sight, it loses its ability to discern. And then this is a dramatic passage. Listen, this is what happens then. Whether there came a whistling wind or a melodious sound of birds in wide-spreading branches, or the rhythm of violently rushing water, or the harsh crash of rocks hurled down, or the unseen running of leaping animals, or the sound of the most savage roaring beasts, or an echo thrown back from a hollow of the mountains, it paralyzed them with terror. So what we see is that in my foolishness, the darkness renders all things terrifying, and I can no longer determine the way things approach. What approaches as gentle, or merely wild, or wild and dangerous, or merely as the echo of my own voice. There's a great difference between the song of the nightingale and the snarl of the panther. But even if we recognize the darkness, we must be able to tell the difference in the dark. Otherwise, the lack of light, which is powerless in itself, becomes a pure horror. And it's in this darkness that the voice of Teresa of Avila comes as such a welcome guide. For as a spiritual director and a contemplative nun, seeking God in prayer, our problem, lay at the center of her life. This is what she spent her life doing. Her constant concern was how to tell the difference between the authentic touch of the divine, the wanderings of her imagination, and the devil clothed as an angel of light. So, I mean, we could talk about Teresa for months, right? But to start our discussion, I want to briefly and programmatically lay out the beginnings of a response that I think we might find in our dilemma in the writings of Teresa. For Teresa, even a deep purification of desire and a close attention to personal experience are not enough to accept a vision or an appearance of truth of God as in fact what it seems to be. Teresa is clear that in the immediate moment there is no way to decide if this is God or not. Illusion and truth are not discernible in the immediacy of a single experience. However, so we can't tell. She says when she has a vision, she can't tell in the final analysis with certainty if this is God or not. However, this does not mean that we must turn to an intellectually transparent metaphysical system to see if our experience matches a pre-given conceptual structure. It's not as if we have to fulfill, for Teresa, Socrates' demand that we give an essential definition so that we will then be able to recognize examples when we see them. She's not going to go that route. It means that we must turn to further experience. Experience of what follows from the appearance in question. For only by looking to its effects can what appears to be true be accepted as true. Immediate experience is interpreted in the light of following experience. By looking to effects. This emphasis on looking to results or effects lies at the heart of Teresa's project. In the fourth mention of the interior castle, the interior castle is probably her seminal work. It's a magnificent piece of literature as well as a spiritual inquiry. She begins saying, I imagined the soul as if it were a single crystal, as if it were made of a single diamond or very clear crystal. So the soul she imagines likens to be a castle with concentric circles, and in the center of the castle is the king, or the divine bridegroom. And so her journey that she takes us on throughout this book is going through these concentric circles, journeying deeper into her heart, which is at the same time a journey towards the transcendence of God. So she tells us in the fourth circle, the will certainly seems to me to be united in some way with the will of God, but it's by the effects of this prayer and the actions which follow it that the genuineness of the experience must be tested. And there's no better crucible for doing so than this. Looking to effects. And this isn't just something for the novice. She tells us through this, she talks about effects over and over and over again. Almost any page in the interior castle, you will see this. It's by the effects which result from this prayer that we shall know if what has been said is true. Again, on the other hand, if the vision is not of the truth, but is an illusion, that also will be recognized by its effects. She says, counterfeits, however, will be recognizable because they will not produce these effects, but quite contrary ones. So, we get these, she says, over and over and over, look to the effects. But we don't get a clear, unambiguous list of what these effects are, or what the criteria she's using by looking to effects. So what I think we want to see from that, from the fact that we have merely an amorphous list of effects, is that what she's emphasizing is a way of interpreting and not a specific technique in which an infallible rule can be followed simply and universally. We see this again by looking to the first effect that she does talk about, which is this idea of growth. So growth is one of the effects that we use as a criterion for truth. The growth that this vision, the first and most consistent criterion Teresa uses to interpret a vision as true is the growth it fosters. In fact, this must accompany any other criterion we might use. In the third mention, Teresa says that the soul will experience some security of conscience as it has grown closer to the divine truth. However, she immediately warns, I say security, but that is the wrong word, for there is no security in this life. So whenever I use it, you must understand the words, unless he strays from the path on which he has set out. So it's only through the actual journey, making progress on this journey, that we can have confidence. We must strive all the time to advance, she says. And if we are not advancing, we must cherish serious misgivings. For it's unthinkable that a soul which has advanced so far should cease to grow. Love is never idle. Anyone who fails to go forward begins to go back. So we have this idea of growth, but this itself in itself is an empty concept. What are we talking about? What are we growing in? So she does give us some other kinds of criteria. These are, most often, peace, freedom from fear, and strength in humility. So these are the kind of criteria by which we are going to judge the coming of the other, as of the divine, or as of my imagination, or as of some dark power. And by now we can start to see the beginnings of an answer, perhaps, to the post-phenomenologists in Teresa's work. To reject a metaphysics of the same, in which all of reality is organized under principles or categories that are already given, does not lead to undecidability. Or a mystifying preoccupation with the break between intentionality and givenness. For even if the coming of the other ruptures my world, or recedes from the horizon of expectation, that's provided for its appearance, it still constitutes an encounter. Every encounter must be tentative because of the problem of desire, and yet because it's encountered through desire, it opens up a relation to the other. And it's through this relation that the other itself can be judged. Teresa judges the other to be the illusion of evil, or the illusion of one's own imagination, when it leads to the isolation of arrogance, the weakness of confusion, and the paralysis of fear. However, this event may also lead to freedom from fear, and thus to deep peace and confidence, to the freedom from alienating desires, and thus to self-ownership, and to the freedom from narcissism, and thus to the openness and of humility and the strength of virtue. In this case, Teresa judges an encounter likely to be true, right? Likely to be of God. We can judge whatever leads from slavery to freedom and happiness as good and real, no matter how far this whatever transcends our categories of comprehension. Now this, of course, if you know the history of philosophy, is to start to talk about Teresa's project in terms that Spinoza would have used, right? To talk about the drive of kinetics, human beings looking for fulfillment, for fulfilled being. And that now we might say, well, we've avoided judging God in terms of categories of understanding, and now we're judging God in terms of categories of my own flourishing being. So we'd still the other collapses back into categories of the self. Well, it's true that for Teresa, truth is relational and relative to the self, but we have to follow her to the end. And the last three that I really briefly want to go through are the effects that we can look at from Teresa are passivity, particularity, and praise. These are the three that I think are really going to help us understand what Teresa is doing and help see how she can address Derrida and that tradition. So this first one is passivity. The otherness that we encounter is first of all an unchosen passivity. That's a break from one's past consciousness. The experience of being overwhelmed that is characteristic of passivity is one of the effects that Teresa uses as a criterion to interpret her experience. And running out of time, so I could just say briefly that for Teresa, she says, this experience of God is something that absolutely overwhelms her world. She says that even the lowest born woman on earth might dare to betroth herself to a king. And yet no human being who understands would dare betroth themselves to God because of the radical alterity. There is so much difference that the encounter with God necessarily requires a great amount of pain. So, along with this passivity, we have this turning away from the self. Again, briefly rushing through here, we can see that authentic vision will result in a self-forgetfulness, which is so complete that it really seems as though the soul no longer existed, because it's such that she has neither knowledge nor remembrance that there is either heaven or life or honor for her. She seems no longer to exist and has no desire to exist. No, absolutely none, save when she realizes she could do something to advance the glory and honor of God. So discernment can never be reduced to the powers of the judging self, because the very ground of this self is challenged by the otherness that we experience in the passivity of desire, something that comes to us. And this is something we find in desire in every experience of desire, right? Desire is something that's unchosen. It's something that comes upon us. However, now we have an awkward fact that this investigation of the passivity of desire places Teresa firmly back in accord with the phenomenologists of alterity. For the desire for God is a rupture into my life, in which my world is undone, and my powers of constituting reality are overcome. This means that one of the very criteria for judgment is that judgment recognize in its inability to provide its own ground and openness to its own surpassing. To appear, the other of desire must not be reduced to the powers of the judging subject. This is a moment of radical transcendence. However, the bare fact of alterity itself cannot be the defining characteristic of this encounter. So we can see that Teresa, in a sense, is back in accord with the phenomenologists of alterity. But we now look to particularity briefly. For our particularity is another criteria for Teresa. The process of judgment includes asking, for Teresa, does the experience in question strengthen my commitment to the particularity of this relation? She says, this is the one that I want and no other. So Teresa shares with contemporary thought the conviction that the power of the soul cannot impose its categories on the otherness of the beloved. However, she's equally clear that it's this beloved that, even if it escapes the grasp of our comprehension, is to be preferred above all others. In the sixth mansion of the interior castle, she writes, "It is conscious of having been most delectably wounded, but cannot say how or by whom. But it is certain that this is a precious experience, and it would be glad if it were never to be healed of that wound." So, we can say this other cannot be determined, and in fact its very alterity causes great pain. But Teresa chooses this relationship over all others and for eternity. For Teresa, this emphasis on particularity, in which only this one will suffice to fulfill my desire, is so radical that desire for all other things, including her own salvation, fall away. So we can reread the effects Teresa lists that we just saw in the seventh mansion, not only as an affirmation of the passivity of the soul before a desire it cannot possess, but as an affirmation of the radical particularity of the desire for God. It is this one all-consuming desire that is able to overcome the insularity of her own project. So she says, "Let us see what new life is like, this new life is like, and how different it is from her earlier one. For it is by the effects which result from this prayer that we shall know if what has been said is true. As far as I can understand, these effects are these. First, there is a self-forgetfulness, which is so complete that it really seems as though the soul no longer existed, because it is such that she has neither knowledge nor remembrance that there is either heaven or life or honor for her." Right, so we see the first part, passivity, being overwhelmed by the alterity of God. And yet she says, so entirely is she employed in seeking the honor of God. Only this God, this particular one. As Teresa nears the end of her journey, no other desire can reach her, neither from the world nor from eternity. So deeply is she immersed in the one desire for her beloved. And this too is a criterion for discerning the truth of desire at the furthest reaches of Teresa's last mansion. And so now we can briefly turn to praise. Following in Teresa's tracks, we seem to have swung back to the other horn of our dilemma. For in affirming particularity, we necessarily affirm our confidence in the ability to choose this one. And this choice excludes the others. However, by turning to Teresa's final and highest criteria, we see that the act of praise is able to unite these two horns in a dynamic tension. The dialectic between openness to alterity, in which my powers of judgment are confounded, and the closeness, in which I say, this is the one that I want, none other, comes to fruition, I think, in a dynamic tension in praise. We've seen that growth is both a criterion for discernment and an accompanying judgment that underlies the identification of the other criterion. So growth is itself a criteria, and yet we see growth underlying the rest of the things that we've looked at. Peace, freedom from fear. But praise also has this kind of double function, for it serves as a criteria in itself and accompanies all of our other criteria. This time, as the clarifying and completing relation in which they're fulfilled. Thus, if we characterize growth as the dynamic of goodness that lies below clarity, confidence, peace, calm suffering, sweet desire, freedom from fear, all these other things that Teresa talks about, and this is what allows us to see these criteria as manifestations of the unity of a life, it's joy and praise that then raise them up to their lowest criteria of transcendence. So in the sixth mansion, Teresa writes, "The devil could not possibly infuse a joy and peace into the very center of her being, which makes her whole delight consist in urging others to praise God." So praise and joy are the summation and response to all the other effects and relations that have guided Teresa on her path. And we see this in several places again, but we find it perhaps most strongly in the closing chapters of the interior castle, where she says, "In this state of prayer, a person is rendered by this jubilee so forgetful of self and everything else that she can neither think nor speak of anything but praising God, to which her joy prompts her." Let us all join her, my daughters, for why should we wish to be wiser than she? What can make us happier? And may all creatures unite their praises with ours forever. So here we see the progress of growth of the soul fulfilled in a radical turn away from the self that is at the same time recognized as the completion of the soul's deepest desires, in the experience of a joy beyond all others that can only be expressed as praise. Right? But if this idea of praise is to be some kind of a summation for us in our understanding of our relation with God, it's not one, again, that can be fully clarified merely in some kind of a structural analysis. So we see, I'll take one last quote from Teresa. She says that in the closing pages of The Interior Castle, although I have spoken here only of 7 mansions, yet in each there are comprised many more, both above and below and around, with lovely gardens and fountains and things so delectable that you will want to lose yourselves in praise of the great God who created it in his image and likeness. So this means that an understanding of praise cannot be revealed in a brief programmatic outline. It must derive from a detailed study of the kinds of acts of praise that emerge from the joy that arises in responding to the invitation to take up the call of desire in all the diverse ways that this call can be taken up. However, even though praise is always a provisional fulfillment, subject to the demands of the concrete call of desire, it does provide some mediation between the tension that we have seen between self and other. And it's this stable formulation of praise that finally allows Teresa to account to rest between the centrifugal forces of post-phenomenology's fascination with the radical alterity that ruptures my world of meaning, and the centripetal forces of a pragmatism that ultimately must judge reality according to the powers of life and self that surge into the world. For the final meaning of the self appears in a self-eclipsing towards the other in praise. But this praise can never be separated from its status as a response to the joy that has resulted from an increasing intimacy in taking up the invitation to relation presented by the givenness of the other. Thus, we see an increasing violence that the other exerts over the subject as he or she submits his or her autonomy to respond to the call of the other. But this violence doesn't have the final word. It's praise alone that's able to know of this one, because it willingly submits to the particularity of that which draws it, and thus to the violence by which one subjects one's own projects and available will. But this is not merely an abasement before an indifferent power that destroys the self's ability to affirm the meaning it experiences. For since desire is a pathos, before an end the subject did not choose. But in praise, the self's continuity with itself is revealed. Praise is a radical break with our own self-reflexivity and with the projects and choices of the self. However, the experience of praise is always joyful. So this movement that allows the appearing of desire is not merely a neutral dynamism. There is a kind of completion in the openness of desire. For the praise and joy that accompanies it are the fulfillment of the promise of the desired object to matter. So praise is not a shortcut through the long route of discernment, but as it too is purified, it says ever more clearly, there is something good in the world. I submit to this goodness, and in that there is joy. So thank you very much for that, and thank you for Dr. Pungo, who will respond now. I gave him this paper about 3 hours ago, right? So he has had no time to prepare. But we'll hear something from him, please, and then we can hopefully see where this takes us in our conversation. Thank you.
Yeah, Dr. Palmer looked quite gracefully
agreed to stand in for our colleague, Father Tim Clancy, whose father just died. So, Dr. Pomelo got his BA from Georgetown in 68 and graduated with a PhD from Northwestern University in 1977. He's the second most senior member of the philosophy department. So, Dr. Pomelo, thank you.
Would you be willing to...
Oh, sure.
Yes, just strictly for us.
Well, I dare not advocate the power and glory of that shallow Bertrand Russell, so we'll say no more about that shallow pate today. As was just indicated, I was asked to do this yesterday afternoon, and I got a copy of the paper you just heard earlier this afternoon. So you should not expect what I'm going to say to be a direct response or commentary on what you just heard. What I had to work with, for the most part, was the title that Dr. Calhoun gave us, Can I Know It Is God Speaking to Me? So given that that's what I had to work with, what you're going to hear from me is a radically different alternative perspective on the issue from what you just heard, although there's a little bit of common ground in the sense that I want to start with Socrates as well, and in the sense that I'm interested in the Abraham story as a kind of test case for what we're talking about. So, can I know it is God speaking to me is the question. Socrates, in Plato's Euthyphro, tries to show that the gods approve of what's morally good because it's morally good, rather than it being good merely because the gods approve of it. This raises the question of whether God could approve, for example, of our torturing people just for the fun of it, and thus make that sort of behavior right. Do we believe in a reasonable God where reason is somehow analogous to ours, or do we not? If so, could such a God arbitrarily make torture right and generosity, for example, wicked? What's at stake here is sometimes called the divine command theory in ethics. If God commands something, we ought to do it, regardless of our human moral standards, according to the divine command theory. So that's basically number one on your sheet. Moving to number two. This brings us to the Abraham story, or at least the part of it that now I want to focus on. I had originally meant to focus on both parts that were mentioned, but since I think a splendid job was just done with Genesis 18, I want to focus on the other part of the Abraham story from Genesis 22. The story in which God allegedly commanded Abraham to sacrifice Isaac, his only beloved son. According to the story, Abraham did everything necessary to obey this command and was stopped at the last dramatic moment from killing Isaac by one of God's angels. Happy ending, right? But what matters philosophically is that Abraham chose to obey God's command to the point of committing what human morality considers murder, with his own son being the victim. Is this morally monstrous? Is this morally admirable? What shall we make of it? In one of his greatest works called Fear and Trembling, Kierkegaard, the Christian existentialist, philosophically reflects on this part of the Abraham story and this issue. The universal rule of morality, which for Kierkegaard is represented by Kantian ethics, categorically forbids deliberately killing an innocent person as murder. But the particular personal relationship between Abraham and his God seems to require it as an act of sacrifice, and thus not murder at all. Kierkegaard maintains that the universal rules of morality in a case like this are legitimately subordinated, in particular circumstances, to the demands of a faith relationship. He calls this a, quote, teleological suspension of the ethical, close quote. Ethical obligations are not abolished, but in the circumstances suspended in deference to a higher end, such as one's relationship with God. Kierkegaard puts the alternatives quite baldly for us. Either Abraham is an admirable man of faith, or he's a murderer. But is this either or adequate? Moving on to number three. Now, I don't want to accuse Abraham of being a murderer, especially in the Catholic school for which I work. Abraham loved Isaac, wanted the best for Isaac, surely did not wish Isaac dead. And to the extent that the Abraham story is credible, I have no doubt that Abraham was indeed a man of faith. But I want to suggest that the man of faith, however earnest and sincere, can nevertheless be deluded, believing in an hallucination. To the extent that I believe the Abraham story at all, I think this must have been the case, because I believe in a God, quote unquote, God, that would require moral agents to do things they believe to violate the moral law is unacceptable. But then how can we tell whether a belief is rationally acceptable or an irrational delusion? Here I turn to John Locke. Locke was born during the Thirty Years' War. Why do I mention that? Because the Thirty Years' War was a violent conflict in which Catholics and Protestants were killing each other in the name of their shared Christian religion. And Locke died near the beginning of the Age of Enlightenment, which he helped to inspire. Locke is understandably worried about what he calls enthusiasm, quote unquote, what we would call religious fanaticism. Believing in a rational God who created us as rational creatures, Locke holds that it is unacceptable to attribute anything contrary to reason to God's will for us. Granting that the divine reason is not identical to human reason, there must be some analogy between them. Otherwise, it's nonsense to speak of God as reasonable. And as we only have direct access to our own human reason, we must try to use it as our touchstone for deciding or determining what is and what is not worthy of our faith. We may never be sure what God has revealed, but we can be certain, according to Locke, that anything contrary to reason is not from God, as it cannot be true. To fail to use the reason that God gave us as what Locke calls our judge and guide in everything is to expose ourselves to the dangers of fanaticism, or what Locke would call enthusiasm. Number four. Like Kierkegaard and Locke, Immanuel Kant, the philosopher I follow, was a Christian. He's famous for developing our ethical theory of moral duty as categorical or absolutely, unconditionally binding. And again, this is the model of ethics that Kierkegaard tends to use. For Kant, the God of Christianity is essentially rational, personal, and moral. Not what Nietzsche calls beyond good and evil at all, and not the arbiter of what is good and evil. Reason is that arbiter. We humans, as Kant puts it, at least have a negative criterion, close quotes, for determining whether something is commanded by God. If it violates moral duty, as determined by reason, it cannot be from God. Kant adds these words by way of illustration. He says, for example, were a father ordered to kill his son, who is, so far as he knows, perfectly innocent, close quotes. And now this is an obvious reference to the Abraham story, even though the name of Abraham is not used in that passage, perhaps for fear of offending Judeo-Christian sensitivities. But much later, Kant explicitly writes about, quote, the command delivered to Abraham to slaughter his own son like a sheep, close quotes, warning of the unavoidable possibility of mistaken interpretation here. Finally, the last point, number 5. On this view, which is compatible with Socrates and opposed to Kierkegaard's view, morality must be regarded as autonomous and not a function of religious doctrine. And the view being espoused here is in concord with Locke's position that reason must be our ultimate arbiter. We are warned against the idolatry of human reason, of course. Surely idolatry of any sort is bad. It's dangerous. But what better rock of stability to fall back on in the entire realm of our experience do we have than our own reason? The alternative, I think, is the opposite danger of the fanaticism against which Locke tried to warn us. It seems monstrous to hold that Abraham ought to be willing to kill his innocent son because he fancies that God wills his doing so. How do we draw any significant line between that and, to take a cheap shot, saying that it was right that fundamentalist Muslim terrorists tried to kill as many innocent American Christians as possible by crashing passenger jets into the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center in September of 2001 because they honestly believed that was God's will? Is it better to believe in a God, if you can call it God, that orders us to intend the murdering of a son who is innocent and loved, or to suspect that such a notion is some sort of delusion? You decide for yourself. I've obviously done so for myself. Thank you.
Well, thank both of our speakers. This is the tradition at the Socratic Club. We leave time for questions and discussion, so Dan would come on back up here. If you'd like, direct your questions to one of the speakers, or you can just ask a general question that they can both. Jungle is a hot potato, so questions, go ahead.
I have a question concerning you. Mm-hmm. I've heard before that, like, the reason that God told Abraham to kill Isaac was because Isaac had become an idol for Abraham and Sarah, containing all their hopes and dreams. And then you look at Jesus, and Jesus says, in order to follow me, you have to give up your family. You know, or at least love, put God, trust God more than you trust your family.
Right.
And if Isaac was an idol for that, then it would make sense that God might say that.
If Abraham and Sarah were guilty of idolizing Isaac, that's their fault, not Isaac's fault. So to require of Abraham, even given that hypothesis, you know, that what it's all about is sort of dealing with the issue of this kind of idolatry of one's own family, to order Abraham, therefore, to murder his son, if you can call it murder, or if you like, to sacrifice his son, still seems the kind of injustice that would, I think, have to be attributed to a being that I myself would not regard as God. I mean, I'll be damned. Damned if I would worship such a being myself.
Yep. But the story like still ends where God prevents Abraham from killing Isaac. So
sure. It has the happy ending.
Abraham a lesson.
Right.
So it's still all about Abraham if he's the one who's creating the idol.
So that makes it okay, you know, that it has the happy ending and the angel steps in and stops Abraham and you don't really have to do it. Just kidding, Abraham. Go home. And
well, it wasn't just kidding. It was like a teaching.
It wasn't. It was a test. You know, it was a test of Abraham being tempted by God to see whether he would stand the test. Yes. Anyway, that's my answer.
Okay.
What I did say is that God was not the agent of Jesus' death. whether God intended that other human beings would be the agent is, you know, part of the divine mind that I'm not going to pretend to penetrate. But I can't believe in a God that's going to do anything unjust, including being directly responsible for the death of an innocent. And as far as I know, apart from cursing the fig tree, Jesus of Nazareth was utterly innocent.
I think that's a great analysis. I would follow that down the line. I don't think that there's anything that orthodoxy requires us to say God intended the death of Jesus. I think that there's a possibility for us to interpret this as this was a gift of love sent to humanity, that humanity was not in a position to be able to take, precisely because of the alterity of God. We were not able to take this on board because of human ways of thinking. But I think to go back to the last question with Abraham, I as well would say Abraham deciding to sacrifice Isaac was a mistake. I don't think this was God's voice, and I think it was an illusion. I think this was an illusion that came to Abraham. But my question would be, how are we going to decide whether that was an illusion or not? And it would have been a mistake for him to kill Abraham. I don't think God ever would have told him to do that. But the problem for me becomes, how are we going to decide whether this is God's voice or not? And the Abraham story is very hard, because we want to say, yes, killing your child is murder. But the problem of Jesus, I think, is much better. In Corinthians, Paul tells us the Jews were not able to understand Jesus as God because of their understandings of what the Messiah would be. They understood the Messiah as someone who would restore them to their power as a kingdom, who would throw off the yoke of the Romans, right? I don't have the quotation, but Paul tells us this. He says the Jews were not able to understand Jesus as God because of their understanding of what God was. He says the Greeks weren't able to accept Jesus as God because of their understanding of what God is. Right? That's why he says Jesus came as foolishness as a scandal to the wise. Right? And it took us a long, long time historically. If you think, it wasn't until the Council of Ephesus in 431 that we finally were able to hammer this out, that yes, Christ is in part of the Trinity, Christ is God, right? And Jesus is Christ. Because this is so foreign to our way of understanding of God as immutable and all-powerful. How could God suffer? So it took 400 years of people like Clement of Alexandria and Gregory of Nyssa and Origen. These guys were like bulldogs for orthodoxy. And why did it take so much effort and so much struggle? And I think it's because we had this idea. I respect Socrates so much, but in this case, that we are going to is Jesus God? How do we know? Well, we have a definition of the essence of God, which is as immutable, right? So how could he suffer? Therefore, it can't be God. So I think it was our appeal to our concepts, which is why it was so hard, and whether Jesus was God or not is something we can debate. But for it's a serious claim that we have to take serious as philosophers. And what Paul's telling us is because of your philosophy, you would not be able to see that. You are blind to that. You were blind to Jesus as God because of philosophy.
Yeah, I want to jump in on that. I think you're exactly right, that the key issue here is how do we decide? You know, the question as I was given it by Dr. Calhoun is, can I know it's God speaking to me? And notice that in the original presentation and my comment, you got the two sides of a coin to answering that. You got the positive side derived from St. Teresa about what criteria or earmarks can serve to help you decide that something is God speaking to you. And for me, you got the negative side. What are the indications you can use to decide that it's not God speaking to you? You know, so in a sense, we came down on different sides of answering that question, but we're both focused on the answer to that question.
And it gave the same answer, that God telling Abraham to kill Isaac was not God.
By the way, I love the other part of the Abraham story, which I knocked out of my commentary because I thought it was already dealt with so well. If I have great problems with Abraham taking Isaac up Mount Moriah, which I do, I love Abraham dickering and bickering with God about the justice of what God has commanded. That appeals to the Kantian in me.
It might be interesting to consider cases in which the two sides of your coin counterpoint. Teresa points to various, primarily psychological and interrelational benefits and effects of the alleged buying experience as her criteria. The other criteria that has been suggested have been the criteria of reason. I give you the Tom Cruise effect. Adherence to a what seems to me perfect adapt religious tradition, Scientology, aided by a considerable measure of personal wealth. Remember here Mark Twain's famous comment, well, money can't buy happiness, it sure does calm the nerves. Here we have a man who has reaped, at least according to his own report, considerable psychological benefits similar to those described by Teresa, but violates most of the accepted canons of religious reason. So, right. Does Tom Cruise receive the revelation of God, or has he not?
I think that's helpful for thinking through what I want to say is the challenge that's laid down to us by the Levinas and Kierkegaardian tradition. And this is that most of the time we're going to come to the same results, I think. And what I hope we would gain from Teresa isn't that we start over every time and say, is Scientology right or not? But that our criteria aren't some kind of divorced critical thinking, but rather a tradition and a history. So we come to this idea that murder, God would never tell Abraham to murder his son. Not because we have somehow captured the essence of God with our thinking, and then can compare this example to if it's God or not, but rather because throughout our history, there is a covenant with God and a history of a culture where they've worked these things through. So they've become kind of stable and confident principles.
Well, I think I find that very suggestive, and it's notable that so far that's the first time in discussion of the issue of traditions. However, there's a fairly uniform tradition of interpreting the Genesis 1-2 clean against you. And I give you the uniform tradition of Jewish commentary on Genesis 22, which asserts, as far as I can remember from all commentators, that God did indeed demand that sacrifice of Isaac.
Okay, again, that I could be completely wrong. That's just where I would come from as a personal, immediate response to that, without knowing much of the tradition. But that then becomes my idiosyncratic reading.
Then we're back to basically a subjective criterion.
No. Because the kinds of criteria that I think Teresa gives us do get built up throughout the tradition. Right? And in making an appeal to a claim about is this God or not, then you have to look at the tradition as well as your own personal experience.
But that seems to be why the Holocaust of Isaac is so important, because it shows us that the limits of our capacity to conceptualize the conditions under which God engages. Is that your point?
I don't have a positive point. And it just seems to me that the criteria come apart.
And then you have to choose.
Well, once again, then it seems to be mainly a matter of final on that view of personal decision, which is not yet the appeal of either to reason or psychological effects or tradition.
Okay. This is where I would say that these effects aren't psychological. They're objective criteria that have to do with objective relations in the world.
Well, I don't suppose the psychological effects are merely subjective.
Because in the
surely when she talks about peace, freedom, fear, and confusion, and so on, she's describing
No, I don't think so. Because they are openness to the world. Freedom from fear isn't a feeling.
The psychological effects always both arise from and condition a human relationship. That's how you get to have psychology in the first place.
Right, but so isn't then that not merely subjective? Because it's not having to do with some with emotions.
No, I didn't say merely subjective, just that it was subjective.
It is, it's partly
not
subjective.
Merely subjective. But I want to suggest that the criteria that you are suggesting do not always agree with one another, and when they don't, if they come apart, or if the criteria one set is satisfied and another is not, then in what sense are they criteria?
That's what she says. It's an amorphous group. There's no absolute final basis for decision. Because if there were, then you would be claiming to have a conception of God, right? And then, if you have a conception of God, how could God truly transform your life? How could God truly enter into your world if you already have the concept that you're going to use to then discern? I mean, I'm still working this all through myself, but doesn't that seem to be then God could never reach you?
Is that right? Well, he could reach you quite easily, as for example, he could command you to sacrifice your own beloved son. A communication which takes
and
which certainly puts them in the trash.
So then you would automatically exclude that.
I'm sorry?
Would we automatically exclude that then?
Would I do that?
Right.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's a total delusion.
So would you automatically exclude the fact that God could suffer and die?
I have no idea whether God could do that or not. It certainly seems to me that if God exists at all, he ought to suffer.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But the point here, it seems to me, is that in seeking for criteria, and this is precisely where Socrates catches Euthyphro. Euthyphro ought to have said, Socrates, I'm not going to play that game. Mm-hmm. He had an entirely other game, which did preoccupy, which Socrates ignores entirely in his comments and questions. Euthyphro had an entirely different rationale for what he was doing there in the court of Athens.
Mm-hmm.
He was seeking to remove the pollution which his father's action had visited upon his tribe. And tells Socrates that. He says, I'm here to commit an act of catharsis to prevent the pollution from spreading into my kinship group. He takes advantage of a well-known theory, readily available in Socrates' day, but later denied by others. And Socrates runs roughshod over it. Euthyphro's foolishness was in playing the game of offering criteria, which just get defeated one after the other quite easily,
mm-hmm.
and reason is not.
I think we can't avoid altogether elements of subjectivity. I think faith itself is a subjective matter. The kinds of criteria, which are pragmatic, psychological and pragmatic criteria that Teresa invokes, have an element of subjectivity. Perhaps even our interpretation of what's reasonable and what does or does not accord with the categorical imperative involves an element of subjectivity. But is it a vicious subjectivity? And I think the answer is not necessarily. To the extent that criteria, such as Teresa's, are intersubjectively analyzable and experienceable, they pass out of the realm of sheer subjectivity. To the extent that intersubjectively we can relate to standards of reason, standards of moral judgment, to that extent they're not sheer subjectivity. So, I appreciate you're saying you're not saying it's purely subjective, and I think that what he's talking about and what I'm talking about are not purely subjective. But at the same time, I appreciate your concern that the subjective cannot be eliminated here,
respond. No, I have no positive concern here. I'm just trying to poke.
Respond, and I and my only
positive view to advance.
My only attitude on that is, why should we eliminate the subjective? We're human beings reflecting on our human experiences. How can that ever be purely objective? I mean, what's wrong with saying there is an element of subjectivity here?
Oh, nothing at all. It seems to me, indeed, that finally, then, your best recommendation is to find a consonance between demands of reason, demands of subjective experience, demands of interrelational or social experience, and demands of tradition. Mm-hmm. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that.
It is, and I am not absolutely here to defend that position. I'm just very interested in the challenge that throws down for us as thinkers.
We're a little over time already, so if the conversation seems to need to continue, so if you have a few extra moments, stick around. Let's thank our speakers again.